This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good evening, this is Orson Welles, your producer of a special series of broadcasts presented by the makers of Pabst Blue Ribbon, the Mercury Summer Theater of the Air.
Tonight and every Friday night, Pabst Blue Ribbon presents you with a front row seat at one of the greatest plays ever produced. So, while America's famous producer, writer, director, Orson Welles, entertains you, pour yourself a tall, frosted glass of Pabst Blue Ribbon.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Bookmark on The Bigger Picture. I'm Umar Paganampake Pagan, and this is 50 Books in 50 Weeks, brought to you in collaboration with Borders.
This evening, Mr. Welles and the Mercury Players bring to the microphone The Great Romance by Alexandre Dumas, The Count of Monte Cristo.
Now, I enjoy big, fat books. Those intimidating doorstoppers, enthralling enough to retain attention against the warring attractions of the internet and instant messenger, of film and television, of Facebook and Twitter. I enjoy the big book because it really gives me something to sink my teeth into. It's the slow burn, the long game. But not all big books are created equal. Not all big books are for every occasion. You see, the complex literary prize winners, those Man Booker Prize winners, they're to be digested slowly on your daily commute on the LRT with bad coffee in a paper cup and rain worming across the windows. But when you're home on a Sunday morning, you want something thrilling, something classy in a classic jacket. You need Jeffrey Archer, Robert Ludlum, Tom Clancy. Heck, you need some Alexandre Dumas. You need The Count of Monte Cristo. You can keep your Three Musketeers, you can keep your Man in the Iron Mask. To me, Monte Cristo is the peak of Alexandre Dumas' oeuvre. It demonstrates his inimitable mastery of high adventure, deadly intrigue, revenge, and general derring-do.
It was a continuous scratching, as if made by a huge claw, or some iron instrument scraping against the stones. Then all was silent. Soon it began again, nearer and more distinct. Perhaps it was only a workman repairing a neighboring dungeon. I would soon find out. The sound continued. With my earthenware jug, I knocked against the wall where the sound came. Each time I knocked, the knocks were repeated on the other side of the wall. When I stopped knocking, the other also stopped. After that, there were no more sounds. The night passed in complete silence. I never closed my eyes. 3 days passed, 3 long days. Never a sound. At last, on the fourth evening, whoever it was quite close to me now. I wanted desperately to help him, but I had nothing, no knife or sharp instrument. I smashed my earthenware jug. That night I moved my bed out from the wall, moved it out from the wall and started to scrape the plaster with a piece of the broken jug. Soon the fragments of plaster began to fall away. In 3 days I uncovered a large stone, and the next day about noon, the stone began to move.
It is 1815, and Edmond Dantès is a 19-year-old merchant sailor. He returns to port in Marseille, rich in nature's blessings, handsome, clever, and well-made. He's about to be named captain of his ship and to marry his Catalan fiancée, Mercedes. Life is good, but not for long. Framed by his jealous rivals as a Bonapartist traitor, Edmond Dantès is arrested on his wedding day and summarily imprisoned. Dante is incarcerated in the notorious Chateau d'If for 14 years. Here he receives an extensive education from the Abbé Faria. In the next cell, acquires an aristocratic, unearthly pallor, allowing him later to masquerade as both a lord and a vampire, and is told the location of an unimaginable treasure, a barren island known as Monte Cristo.
To measure appeared the head, then the shoulders, and lastly the body of a man. In the prison, he was known as the Mad Priest. I never learned his name. For 8 years, we saw each other every day, using the tunnel he had dug through the solid rock, concealing the mouth of the passage with stones carefully fitted into place. By the sundial he had traced on the wall of his cell, we knew the hours of the guard's visit. The rest of the time, we were together. He had been a great scholar in his day, and all that he knew, he taught me with infinite, with loving patience, day after day, year after year. Then one morning I found him standing.
Staging a daring escape, Dante finds the treasure, but his life is irrevocably changed by his imprisonment. The years of his youth are lost. His father has died in penury. Mercedes, his betrothed, believing him gone forever, has married Fernand, his arch rival, and borne him a son. Donning a myriad of disguises and aliases, Dante sets out to wreak havoc among those who cost him so dear. Despite its plethora of plot strands, places and characters, and its layers of detail rendered with a miniaturist's anxious exactitude, The Count of Monte Cristo remains compulsively readable. In part, this is because of its unrestrained richness. It's full of diamond-bedecked horses, picturesque bandits, and letters of unlimited credit. This book is also chock-full of memorable melodramatic crises.
I declare to my nephew Guido Spada, my sole heir, that I have buried in a cave of the island he knows all that I possess of ingots, gold, monies, jewels, and diamonds, which treasure may amount to nearly 10 millions of Roman crowns. 10 million crowns?
Now, my son, with my dying breath, I leave this treasure to you. You must claim it. If ever you are free, you must go to the island. To the island of Monte Cristo.
But I think Dante's narrative is most addictive because it's a forerunner to the classic superhero story. It is, in essence, the world's heaviest comic book. The Count has a great deal in common with Batman. In his new incarnation, he is unrecognizable to almost everyone, and he has powers which seem almost supernatural, but which, in fact, derive from his limitless resources. He's driven by past trauma and injustice, but is ultimately forced to confront the fact that he, too, has strayed from the side of the angels, becoming almost as pernicious as the villains he persecutes.
I came back with a stretcher. Quickly, I got into the sack in the place of the corpse. I laced the sack around my body. I lay stiff, hoping they would not hear the beating of my heart.
Here we go. You take the head, I take the feet.
All right. Up she goes.
I've got him. Here we go.
Funny thing. You feel him through the sack? Him dead 12 hours and he's still warm.
Hold it while I open this door. Oh, Lord, it's cold up here. It'll cool him off. If you've got the lead weight, tie it on around his feet. All right.
Dante's extraordinary journey from youthful naivete through madness, torment, and calculated revenge to an eventual peace, relinquishing his ultimate vengeance, remains as incredible and relevant today as it did in 1844. Possibly even more so. I'm talking The Count of Monte Cristo. This is 50 Books in 50 Weeks, brought to you in collaboration with Borders. Bookmark the bigger picture, BFM 89.9.
is Orson Welles again, ladies and gentlemen, and just time for the second act curtain of The Great Romance by the great romancer Alexandre Dumas, an old Mercury favorite, The Count of Monte Cristo.
You're listening to Bookmark on The Bigger Picture. I'm Umar Pagan, Ampike Pagan, and this is 50 Books in 50 Weeks, brought to you in collaboration with Borders.
In September 1834, there appeared in Marseille a man of about 40, of a pallor that was almost livid. He gave the impression of one who had been enclosed for a long time in a tomb. This man inquired for a tailor of the city called Caderousse.
My name is Caderousse, monsieur.
There are a few questions I'd like to ask you, Monsieur Caderousse. In the year 1814, did you know a young sailor by the name of Dantès?
Dantès? Yes. Why do you ask? Is he alive?
He died in prison, and with his last breath, gave me the names of the people here who were his friends. One of them is you, Caderousse. The second is a man called Danglars.
Danglars?
The third, a certain Fernand Mondiego.
Mondiego?
You know these men?
Know them. Do you realize who sent Dantès to prison?
No, tell me.
Two men who were jealous of him. One for love and one for ambition. Mondiego and Danglars.
I thought these two were his friends.
They denounced him as a traitor. They knew he had a letter from Napoleon in exile. Something his dying captain had given him. And it looked bad.
Which of the two denounced him?
Both. Danglars was the sharp one. He wrote the letter, and Mondiego put the letter in the
post. Why was this Danglars jealous of him?
He wanted his job.
This week, I'm talking Dumas' doorstop of Daring Do, The Count of Monte Cristo. Published in the mid-1800s, it is no exaggeration to say Monte Cristo still ranks as one of the most exciting stories imaginable. Every bit as good as anything Steven Spielberg or J.K. Rowling could ever conjure up. Now, my particular version of the book is led by this incredibly perceptive essay by the Italian master himself, Umberto Eco. Eco outlines all of the novel's excesses and weaknesses, but still pronounces it irresistible. And he's right, in every sense. Dumas suffers from logorrhea induced by the simple formula that the more he wrote, the more money he made. The author serialized his works, forcing endless repetition of scenes and dialogue in an attempt to ensure continuity, and thus your 1,200-page book.
Still no word from him. Then, in the end, after a year, she married Mondiego. Now she is one of the greatest ladies in Paris.
A year. She waited a year. Mondiego, Danglars de Villefort. Mondiego, Danglars de Villefort. Ali!
Yes, master?
Ali here, 100,000 francs. Spare no expense. Find out everything there is to know about these three. Every move they've made.
Yes, master.
Find out about their homes, their wives, their children, friends.
Yes, master.
Find out where they got their power, how they made their money, whom they robbed, whom they cheated, whom they murdered.
As Eco notes, Dumas pulls off three spectacular narratives in Monte Cristo. He tells the story of a wronged innocent man, relates a spectacular hidden treasure scenario, and caps the fall and rise of his hero's fortunes with a thrilling series of vendettas, allowing readers the endless satisfaction of seeing retribution delivered with a violent verve. Now, those are technical descriptions of what Dumas accomplishes. Better put, Edmond Dantès makes James Bond, Indiana Jones, and Jason Bourne look in the mirror and wonder why nothing interesting ever happens to them. Among other things, Dantès escapes certain death after being thrown off a cliff while wrapped in a shroud, dabbles with pirates and smugglers, disguises himself as an Italian priest and a British aristocrat, and just for giggles, floats easily among high society and low-life thieves across Europe and the Far East.
You need have no scruples in declining.
Oh, I assure you, I never entertain.
You merely wish to be convinced that your stockholders ran no risk. I understand Baron, they include some of the greatest names in France. The Duke de Mondiego, the Baron de Villefort.
It is not generally known that these gentlemen...
Of course. Now we understand each other. I should like to draw tomorrow the sum of, shall we say, 6 million francs. Half gold, half notes.
6 million francs. As you say, sir.
If I should require more, I will let you know. By the by, purchase me tomorrow 10,000 shares of Austrian Commonwealth.
You have some information about this stock?
You'll find, sir, that I never gamble, except in certainties.
Eventually, Dante is morphed into the Count of the Italian Isle of Monte Cristo. He then commands a hidden grotto filled with otherworldly comforts and a staff of loyal servants ready to serve up cordon bleu cuisine, not to mention untold riches that afford him the luxury of recreating his Neverland wherever he travels. It is enough to make Michael Bay wonder why his movies are so dull in comparison. And of course, Monte Cristo is an expert shot and swordsman. He navigates oceans in a custom yacht, dabbles in potions and poisons, and still manages to know the latest in fashion, opera, and financial speculations. This last carries more than a whiff of contemporary urgency. Fortunes dissolve in hours or days as schemes thinner than the paper they're written on devolve into financial ruin, with panic and yo-yo markets driven by greed and corruption.
This message of his, does the Count of Monte Cristo get to see it?
This message, gentlemen, was lost in transmission.
Rarely has Paris been more intrigued than it was that winter by the mysterious Count of Monte Cristo. It was at the end of December that a great ball was given in his honor by the Baron Danglars.
Count de Monte Cristo?
Professor de Montiego.
We have missed you.
In so short a time, madame.
A strange thought occurred to me.
Yes, madame?
It seems to me that you've been gone longer than I can say. It's an odd idea, Count, but I cannot shake it off.
You must forgive me, Madame Mondiego. I have an appointment with your husband.
Tell me who you are.
Madame, I am the Count of Monte Cristo. And the world is mine.
As much as anything, Dumas sheds a withering light on political machinations and intrigue during the time of Napoleon's Hundred Days. Paranoia and accusations fly with people powerful and otherwise jailed, ruined, even killed by insinuation and negligible betrayals. Monte Cristo may hew to stock characters, but these stereotypes brim with life because of the extraordinary circumstances and delightful coincidences Dumas draws around them. Of course, the three conspirators against Dantes and his youth become respected aristocrats 15 years later, just as the newly christened Count of Monte Cristo begins plotting to balance the ledger.
Before I go, there are certain things I have left to do. Baron Danglars, my credit on your books as of tonight is 16 million francs, worth about 4 million to cover certain stocks I sold short today. Here is a check for 10 million francs made out to cash. I will take half in gold and half in notes.
But surely...
I beg your pardon?
That's a very large
sum.
Oh,
by the way, Baron, you may be interested to learn that less than an hour ago, Anglo-Italian went into liquidation.
But that means...
It means that you three gentlemen are ruined. It means that you, Danglars, have robbed the poor and helpless for the last time.
I'll prosecute you for this. I'll issue a warrant for your arrest.
I don't think you will, Baron de Villefort. Since noon today, there has been in the hands of the Minister of Justice a complete record of the career of Baron de Villefort. Spy, thief, forger, informer...
Who are you?
Who am I? Still you do not know? I know you very well, Fernando Mendiego. And tomorrow all Paris will know you for what you are. Deserter, traitor, murderer.
Who are you? What have we done to you?
You condemn me to slow death. You deprive me of love, of freedom, of happiness.
Just, what is your name?
I have but to pronounce it to strike you to my feet. Look at me, Fernando Mendiego. I am the specter of a wretch you buried in the dungeons of the Chateau d'If. You guess it now, do you not? Or rather, you remember it. For notwithstanding all my sorrows and my tortures, I show you now a face which the happiness of revenge makes young again. A face you must often have seen in your dreams since your marriage. Fernando Mondiego with Mercedes, my betrothed.
You
Yes! I am Edmond Dantes.
Echo, in an unspoken nod to Mark Twain, doubts the aesthetic art of Monte Cristo, but salutes the novel's narrative drive. It's another way of saying it's not necessarily Twain's definition of a classic, you know, something everyone wants to have read but no one wants to read. Instead, because it is so damn readable, Monte Cristo is difficult to put down more than 150 years after first being published.
Count Monte Cristo, I asked you a question. I wonder if your answer was the truth.
Madame.
The girl who made you suffer. I asked you if you'd forgiven her.
Oh, yes. I've forgiven her.
And those who separated you, do you still wish to punish them?
Madame, they have been punished. But my answer is still the same. It is not I who punished them. It was their own past.
Next week, Midnight's Children by Salman Rushdie. You've been listening to 50 Books in 50 Weeks, brought to you in collaboration with Borders. Bookmark the bigger picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.